Well, I'd like to start out by asking everyone to join me in a round of applause and thanks for the organizers and the sponsors for this meeting. So, thank you very much. I came back to my room last night to review my talk and sat down on the bed and plopped the slides on my lap, and about halfway through them I fell asleep. So that either means that the dinner was really good or the talk was really boring. So I fervently hope it's the former and not the latter. How many people have actually analyzed gene chip experiments and looked at microarray data? Okay, so it won't be terribly new to some of you, but maybe some of you will learn something about it, and then the others of you, I hope, will get interested in these kinds of problems. So here's the outline of what I'll talk about. I got interested in these in two ways. One was through the Health Sciences Center, where we have some people working on the cDNA chips. And the other was through my niece, who's a graduate student in molecular biology. She initially was working on the cDNA chips and is now looking at the Affymetrix gene chips. So I'll describe both of them. My niece was primarily interested, after they switched over to the Affymetrix gene chips, in how to analyze the data. So like a true microbiologist, she knows a lot of biology, but she didn't know a lot about statistics. And it can be pretty intimidating, the huge array of numbers. So I tried to go through the algorithms, as were explained in the Affymetrix manual, and I came back reporting to her that I can understand why she and her lab mates were having some problems understanding it. So here's some background. And so first I'll describe the cDNA chips and then the Affymetrix chips, and I'll talk more about the algorithms for the latter. Y'all know that DNA is the genetic code in the cell nucleus, consists of the nucleotides A, C, G's, and T's, and that the genes are the organized strings of nucleotides. And what's of real interest, really, are the proteins, which are the sets of amino acids, which are a triplet of three of these nucleotides. And the proteins actually are made in the cell cytoplasm by the ribosomes. So the trick is to get the genes from the nucleus into the cell cytoplasm. The cell doesn't pass all of the DNA code in there. It first makes a copy, that's cDNA, and then it splices out the introns, and so that's the messenger RNA. So what the gene expression is really is a measure of the activity of messenger RNA. So that's what we're really measuring. There's an assumption that that correlates well with protein activity. But what they're really interested in is what proteins are being manufactured so that you can make more red blood cells or white blood cells or whatever is supposed to be the action. So it's not really clear whether an increase in messenger RNA from one gene plus a decrease in messenger RNA from another gene is what actually codes for the protein. We really don't know what are the interactions here between messenger RNA and protein, but there is this assumption that the higher levels of messenger RNA is indicative of something interesting going on. So my niece's lab is interested in calcium signaling in yeast cells. So what she does is she grows two batches of cells, one with the calcium and one without, waits 30 minutes, harvests the cells, collects the messenger RNA, and then labels the cells with the no calcium with a green fluorophore, and those with calcium with a red fluorophore, mixes them up, hybridizes them to a gene chip. So I'll tell you about the gene chip right now. And that consists of, these are tiny, right, real tiny, and there's a copy of each different gene at each different location on the chip. So you take this little solution that she's got, put it on the chip. The cDNAs from the two different types of those with calcium, one without, the two different types of cells, they swim around, they find their matching partners, and then the computer records the fluorescence at each location. Visually, if it's red, then the gene that's expressed more strongly in the calcium batch will appear red. If the gene is expressed more strongly in the no calcium batch, it will appear green. Yellow if there's not much difference, and black if neither. Just as an aside, she's dealing with yeast, which can handle, which has about 6,000 genes. So all 6,000 genes can appear on the same cell. On the same chip. I asked her about chips for humans and multi-celled animals, and she said generally, of course, those are, you know, there are a lot of genes there. And so typically a chip will contain only one cell type. For example, lymphocytes, and they're usually from well-established lines. Now, what I just described actually is much, much more complicated. So let me put this over here. And this is just, I said in about three lines, what is more fully described by this overall process flowchart. And I won't go through that except just to point out that you can see it's, when I said she hybridizes them, you can see there's an entire step for that. There's an entire step for building the chip. So when they actually put this gene on this chip, there's only a little bit of the gene, and so they have to amplify it. And they do that by PCR, polymerase chain reaction. And that involves a whole purification step and so forth. There's preparing the RNA. There's the labeling of the probe with Psi-3 or Psi-5, which is the green or the red fluorophore. And then the data analysis, which is measuring the fluorescence at those two wavelengths corresponding to those two colors in the spectrum.
That's now on an analog scale at this point.
Correct. Absolutely. And that's going to be a key fact that's going to come along here. So there are all kinds of manufacturing problems you can imagine. There's the consistency of the slide preparation. There's the uniformity of what's called the probes, which are the genes. Now, there's also this issue of how do you get the genes onto the slides? Well, they do something that involves sort of like an inkjet technology. So this is fairly well described, actually, in the Yang and Speed paper in Nucleic Acids Research. There they have 4x4 print tips. At CU they have 4x8. I'll describe it as 4x4 because I have only 5 fingers. That's closer to 16. But the idea is that you've got your wells here of the different genes. Okay, you've got these 16 print tips. Okay, and then they dip into the well, and then they print it on the slide, and then they go back and print the next slide and the next slide. So this is how it's done by mass production. Okay, then they get to the end of the, say, 100th slide. They wash off the print tips, and they come back, and they do the next 16. All right? Go like that. Okay, then they wash it off again. Well, so you can see just from that description that there are all kinds of possible problems that can come up. The pins can wear out. Tips will break. There's non-uniform amounts on the print tips. Background noise levels will differ. Could be spatial effects on the gene chip, right? You know from integrated circuit manufacturing that the edges are sometimes less reliable. And all this will affect the comparisons of values across and within the gene slides. Some of the analysis questions that come up are what's the cutoff level for meaningful expression? So, for example, my niece recognized that for some reason this number 2 seems to keep showing up, and they know that they're supposed to look for genes that have a twofold difference in expression. She says, we know that there are some genes which are calcium-induced, and they don't make the twofold cutoff, and then vice versa, so they're the type 1 and type 2 errors. What are the effects of cell-to-cell variability? I mentioned the mRNA bias problem, which is that we think that there is some correspondence between messenger RNA and protein that's produced, but that relationship is not well understood, and other sources of variability. There are more problems with humans because, of course, not all 30,000 genes will appear on a given slide. With respect to this gene, this print tip issue, in Terry Speed's article that I just referred to over there, is a very nice analysis where he looks at the logarithms of the expression levels from the two at the two wavelengths, and also adjusts for the different pins that were used fact, found that one of the pins was systematically behaved quite differently across the range of genes than the others, and adjusts for that different level as well as the scale. And actually did something more than standard deviations and used as measures of variability, median absolute deviations, MADS. For comparison purposes, it seems as though there was just a series of T statistics, okay, and recognizing the different variances did Welch's T statistics. That's kind of a background on the cDNA chips. The affymetric chips were actually more interesting, if you can actually get the data out of that, they may pose some more opportunities for what we can do with that. The way the affymetrics chips work are the probes are not actually snippets of code from the genes from cells, but they're actually manufactured strings of 25 nucleotides. These 25 nucleotides are fondly known as oligos for oligonucleotides. And remember that there are three nucleotides that form an amino acid and 64 possible combinations, and some amino acids, such as tryptophan, has only one possible coding, TGG, whereas others have as many as six possible codings, like serine and arginine. So the reason I mention that is because when they make these gene chips, each cell has 25 nucleotides on it, and the PM, the perfect match, that actually corresponds to 25 actual nucleotides in a gene of interest. And then right next to it, as sort of some idea of doing paired analysis, is what they call mismatch. And that sequence of 25 nucleotides looks just like the PM, except at base 13. Okay, so it's not clear exactly what they use for that base 13. One could imagine from what we can see over here that there might be better choices than other choices. The folks in my niece's lab said that they assumed that it was as different as possible. I mean, that's what would make sense, but they're not really sure. So the point of that is to say that even though this is supposed to be a paired comparison, if it really did match the PM, it's not clear how badly it would mismatch the MM. Okay. Now, the manufacturing, it works like photolithography. So what they do is they start out with this blank board here or chip, and then they take a screen that has in the first position where every A is supposed to be, they have like a filter, right? So then they put all the A's on there, and then they remove the filter, so now A's are in the right spots, at the right places for the different cells. Then they put the C slide on, then the T, and then the G. Okay, now they've got layer one. So now they go to layer two, okay, A, C, G, and T, and so forth up to 25. So they get these 100 filters, right? So now they've got them all in one place. But you can see that just as we know from integrated circuit manufacturing, there could be all kinds of errors there. First of all, impurity in the nucleotide chemical manufacturing, the screen deformities, the registration issues, and edge effects, spatial effects, and so forth. So so now you put your test cell on there, and if the gene is expressed, in theory, the PM expression level is supposed to be bigger than the MM. Otherwise, the PM should look roughly like the MM. And since the data are fluorescence, it makes sense that somewhere along the line, one ought to use a log transformation. So going through their manual here, what they write is, affymetrics algorithms have been developed as a result of mathematical modeling of data generated from experiments with gene chip probe arrays hybridized with known amounts, really like that word, of target transcripts. The algorithms were optimized using extensive empirical testing. So in trying to understand this, they have two kinds of algorithms. One is called absolute analysis, just looking at one particular type of cell, and the other is called comparison. So, how do we go? First thing is how to measure fluorescence of a particular cell. Okay, remember the PM is right next to the NM. And I think, I'm not sure if I mentioned this, but they actually have, for a particular gene, as many as 16 to 20 oligos per cell. Okay, so they've got a PM and an MM, PM, MM, PM, MM, for, say, up to 20 of them, all referring to snippets from one particular gene. Okay, now we go to the next gene and we get another roughly 32 to 40 cells corresponding to that. So how big are these? Well, if you're talking about the small cell size, they're 24 micrometers by 24 micrometers. The large ones are 50 by 50. The chip size is roughly 12 millimeters square. Now, the resolution here, when they actually go to take a measurement, is 3 millimeters. So if we're talking about the small one here, then you can see that we would end up with 8 by 8 pixels per probe cell. So this is just trying to come up with what's the value of an MM or a PM. First thing they do is they recognize that there might be border problems, so they knock off the outer edge. So now we're left with 36 pixel intensities. And then for some reason they define the expression level as the 75th percentile. Okay. So the only thing I can figure out, and if anybody else has any better ideas, but the only thing I can guess is that we know that the 63rd percentile gives the mean of the exponential, so maybe that's why they did the 75th percentile. Does anybody else have any other mathematical ideas as to why they used the 75th percentile? It would seem that, you know, probably the median or the mean of the logs or something might make a little more sense, but anyway, so that's what they do. Now, the next step, once they have those, is the background signal intensity. Okay, so now here's what they do there. Remember, there are two types of sizes for the cells, 24 or 50. So the number of cells is roughly, if you're dealing with a small one, 262,000 or 65,000. Well, what they do here is they take the entire gene chip. This is a whole lot bigger than it really is, but what they do is they recognize that there's probably some spatial variation. Remember, each one of these has, in this, for the small size, 16,000 or 4,000 in each of these 16 sectors. So they take this entire chip, they divide it into 16 sectors, and they recognize that the background, just sort of the raw level, could differ spatially across the chip. Okay, so they divide it into 16 sectors. So now they're going to try to figure out what's the background level in each of these 16 sectors. So they say, well, you know, we really don't think more than, you know, there's anywhere near 98% of these cells that are being expressed. So we'll just take the lower 2%. They certainly have plenty of cells to choose from, but they take the lowest 2%. That turns out to be 328 cells for the small size or 82 in the larger size. The average, they just do a straight average of the cell intensities, not the logarithms. And then they subtract this average from each probe cell in the sector. Okay, so now they subtract that average. So somewhere around 40 or 160 of those are going to be negative. This kind of puts them in an awkward position, right? Because they recognize that some of these numbers are negative. Okay. So this is, I mean, the idea of doing something that's crudely spatial is probably admirable. Whether that's the best way to do it is questionable. Why they use 2% and why they didn't do a robust average of the log intensities is another question. Okay, so that's just the background cell intensity. And by the way, I'm trying to understand what they're doing so that I can tell my niece whether this 2 that she's using with her twofold correction, twofold change is a good number to use. Okay, I mean, that's all she wants to know is what number she, you know, should she use to have some idea of what's the type 1 and the type 2 error. Okay, now there's something called a noise calculation. So they realize that there's going to be, in addition to kind of this background signal that they need to kind of adjust for, is this noise calculation. And so here what they do is, let's go back to the pixels now, okay? So remember, here there's lowest 2% from which they calculated background. And let's just deal with the 328 here in each sector. Okay. Well, what they do is they take the raw standard deviation of the pixels that were involved in each of those 328. Okay. So they get 328 standard deviations. Again, just the straight values, not the logarithms. And they do something like a standard error of that average. Okay. And then they average the standard errors. You don't need to comment on all of that. Then they do it for each of the background cells. And remember, there's 16 sectors. So they sum all of those. And then they multiply it by a scale factor and a normalization factor. Now, when I first saw this, I thought, oh, okay. Well, they've recognized that the average of the standard deviations is not sigma. So they need to adjust it, you know, by this 0.99 factor, whatever it is. But that's not what the SF and the NF are. Okay. So it turns out that got lots of problems here. Now they've got this Q value, which is supposed to represent sort of this noise. And remember, they've adjusted now, and they've got negative numbers too. And so now, at this point, they go to compare the PM and the MM. Okay. Now remember, there are 20 comparisons that they could do for any one gene. So they summarize the whole thing by just saying it's positive if PM minus MM is greater than or equal to 2Q. But, you know, they also recognize that this ratio is probably in here as well. So they also say, in addition to that, you have to have PM over MM being greater than or equal to 1.5. So they have those two criteria, and that's what they call is a positive pair. Negative if the reverse, you interchange MM and PM. And by the way, this 2 and 1.5 are user changeable, but it's not really clear what you should change it to. Okay, and then remember, there are 16 to 20 probe pairs per gene. So now they just summarize the whole thing by a binomial count, okay, which is the number of positive calls out of these 20. Okay. So let's just suppose under H-naught that's a half, okay, if nothing interesting would be going on. Well, they don't say that. They go through this. And they say, okay, now we're going to look at three measures as to whether the number of positive calls is significant. And so here they are, positive fraction. And by the way, I use here n equals 20, but, you know, sometimes it could be 16. Sometimes it could be even less because they've got some reason to believe that maybe the genes, the fraction is not... that some of these cells might not be working right. Positive fraction, positive to negative ratio, and log average ratio. As log average ratio doesn't use all of the 16 to 20 probe pairs, they use n star. What is n star? Well, if n is less than or equal to 8, then they just use all of them. If it's not, then they actually do something kind of like a Huber here. Okay, they drop the min and the max, they calculate the resulting mean and standard deviation, and then they say, well, if the difference, the absolute difference between PM and MM is greater than 3 standard deviations, then we'll drop that pair for purposes of the log average ratio. Are you confused yet? Ranges for the calls. Sorry?
Do they have a statistician?
Apparently, they have somebody who claims to be a statistician. By the way, I should also say, this is in User Manual 4.0. I was told by the folks at the Health Sciences Center that the algorithms in, that their description of the algorithms in their next version of the software, 5.0, is very sparse. Okay, so there's even less information, but I don't know that for a fact. So now this is even better. Positive fractions. So they've got limits here, okay? Absent if it's less than 0.33. Now, by my binomial calculation, that means that the number fraction is less than or equal to 6. They call it present if it's greater than 0.43. By my binomial calculation, that means x is greater than or equal to 9. And they call it marginal if x is 7 or 8. Okay. Even better is the positive to negative ratio. Okay? That's x over n minus x. Here are their limits, 3 and 4. Unless I'm missing something, sure looks to me like x has to be either less than 15 or greater than 16, and marginal is x is 15 or 16. So, and then the log average ratio where they have some limits there. Rather than using what I think most of us would just automatically think of, which is looking at the logarithm of the odds ratio. Okay. So, let's see here. Now, remember that AF, that NF and SF, okay, that's for purposes of the comparison algorithm. So what might happen is that they've got a baseline chip somewhere, an experimental chip. The chip is analyzed as before. They scale and normalize each chip the way I described earlier. They take as a baseline average the 2% trim mean of all the cells, all of them in the whole chip. The experimental average is the same. There might be a target average, you know. I mean, you might decide, okay, I'm going to just normalize everything to 100. And then they use as the NF and then their SF a ratio of those, presumably so that all chips would have the same average. Okay, now by this time I'm getting tired, but this is the fold change increase. And, of course, this is what they're really interested in. And here's what they do there to determine whether or not there's a fold change. There are two criteria. One is that they look at the difference between the PM and the MM in the experimental chip, the PM and the MM in the baseline chip, and they look to see if that's greater than CT. Okay, CT is calculated by software using the statistical threshold difference threshold of both experimental or baseline data, or it's user-defined. My poor niece was going nuts. PCT is the percent change threshold, and that's this ratio. And it makes some sense in that they're looking for which is the smaller of these two, and if the smaller of those two turns out to be smaller than just the noise level divided by 2, then they say, oh, heavens, I better use the noise level. Fold change decrease is where you interchange X and base. Okay. Well, a rather straightforward analysis here would be, I think, instead, let me see if I put this, yeah, I'll put this here, would be sort of along the lines of what Efron Tibshirani and so forth did in their JASS article in 2001, which is just to reduce the cells from a given gene into their raw PMs and MMs. It turns out it's not really trivial from these experiments to get the PM and the MM out. So someone in David Rock's lab has actually written the code to take the file and actually spit out PMs and MMs. So it is possible to do, although not trivial. And what they do is they take a difference of the logarithms, and they don't actually take the straight difference. They look at some values of C here. There are some people who think you should just use C equals 0, just ignore the MMs altogether. It's a little questionable exactly what the MMs would be doing because of this issue I told you. It only differs from the PM in that 13th base pair. C equals 1, of course, would be the ratio of the logs. C equals a half is what they ended up using. And the reason was, they said, biologically, not so sure what the MM is doing. And also, they do a kind of likelihood, probability of recognizing a change in expression level in the gene, given the data. And they have some plots to indicate that this likelihood is maximized at C equals a half, which is a mild advantage, but other comparisons confirmed its superiority. Little value in using trim means is what they wrote. When I looked at the plots, it didn't look like there was really much difference between C equals a half and C equals 1. But that's just been, they admitted they didn't put everything in there. In an article in 1995, Rock and Lorenzato did some interlab studies where Ys were measured concentrations, and they used this model for what the variance of the response was. This would be similar to fluorescence. It probably makes sense to be thinking about what kinds of transformations one would use in order to have a homogeneous variance. When you back this out, just using first-order Taylor series expansion for what would be the variance of a transform data, you come out with an expression that looks like that. That looks like roughly that transformation would look like y when y is small, look like log y when y is big. And Tukey used to call these kinds of transformations where you have one transformation at one end and another at another one at the higher end. He used to call those hybrid transformations. This might actually be sort of some intuitive value why a hybrid transformation might work. Okay, so I'm going to now zip over to this issue of multiplicity, and testing. And so I'm going to take 5 more minutes. Is that okay? Because we start a little bit late. It's okay. Okay. So I think I mentioned that in some of the other articles, they just do kind of Welch's, a whole series of t-tests, 6,000 genes, 6,000 choose 2. We're talking lots of t-tests. False discovery rate is something that has hit the genetics field. That's from Benjamini and Hochberg. People heard of FDR? Yes? No? Yes? Okay, good. Now, they've got some more recent work. That actually assumed, the original FDR assumed that the tests were independent. They've done some more recent work to deal with multiple testing when the test statistics are not independent. It seems from reading through this that the positive correlation is really not is not really the problem. The negative correlation might present a problem. And so sort of an overall fix for this is where they take this Q instead of saying it's 0.05, they adjust Q to a smaller value of Q according to the number of tests. Remember, if you're doing 6,000 choose 2, that's a very big number. And hence what happened, the Health Sciences Center people told me, they're a little unhappy with this adjustment because this is only 6,000 tests. If you did 6,000 choose 2, you've got a whole bunch more tests. And this Q value then goes down substantially. And now they're not getting as many significances. And that's not, they're not happy about that. So the question comes up, which, if it's a positive correlation among the genes, and let's not among the test statistics, then let's not worry about it. But what about if it's negative correlation? So I was just kind of, I've always been kind of curious about this. Maso and Tukey have this COB that they have for a robust estimate of correlation. Some people have already looked into this, I suppose, but I hadn't. So I was just kind of curious to fool around with that and see how well it does. And in the interest of time, I'll just put up the equations there and tell you that I did some quick simulations where N was either 20 or 50, 20 if you had 20 gene probes, looked at seven different levels of correlation, looked at the uncontaminated case where the X's and Y's were just bivariate normal, and the contaminated case where the raw stuff that you put in were actually contaminated normals. And then I calculated R-reg, S squared by, and R-reg on the residuals, and then put in the B that you get from your R-reg into that formula, and so forth and so on. And it turns out it really doesn't work very well. I'm not going to show the all of these plots here, but it turns out it's not bad, but I spent too long on all the other stuff. The simulation results here. This is the actual correlation multiplied by 1,000. This is the mean and the median of the distributions. Maybe I'll just show one of those real quick. For the different, let's do this one. For the different situations, n equals 10, and n equals 20, and n equals 50 for the contaminated and the uncontaminated situations. And so here's a picture. So this was, let's see, this is 0.9, 0.6, and 0.3. At zero, it seemed to do pretty well. And the further you get into row, the less well it does. Here's 0.3 and 0.6. You can see it's really biased, and at 0.9, it's horribly biased. So not working real well there. Okay. But might not be bad for at least assessing direction of the correlation, either positive or negative. That's the wrong one. So the next question that I had was, how well does false discovery rate work on correlation matrices? These are the last three slides. False discovery rate to identify high correlations in a correlation matrix. So I did another small simulation experiment. Given a known correlation matrix among k variables, generate 1,000 vectors, compute your correlation matrix, use false discovery rate on the k times k minus 2 over 2 estimate correlations, and ask which ones were captured or missed. I was trying to come up with a realistic R other than something like tuplets or tridiagonal or other known correlation matrices that probably never occur in practice. So I grabbed my 3,053 U.S. counties, the cancer rates, and some of the variables associated with that, prostate cancer mortality rates, used logarithms for those, measure of urbanicity, how urban is the county, log of total county population, X5 and X6 are very highly correlated, and some environmental variables. And this is roughly what those correlations look like, times 10. times 100, excuse me. The graphical display down below, the actual numbers above. The high ones are, this was between the two measures of size of the county. So you can see that was very high, 0.93. And then I threw in some zeros just to make sure that it would, and kept it positive definite. That's what the correlation matrix looks like. Standardized all of the variables, by the way. Let's see, we've got k equals 11, 1,000 observations. 32 non-zero correlations. So the question was, how often did we actually get from the simulation, how many correlations were significant? Many times it was either dead on with 32 or very close, between 30 and 34. 93% of the time it was within two of the correct numbers. Which ones were most often missed? 92% of them corresponded to these three correlations, which are really tiny. So those are of questionable utility anyway. Which ones most often were inserted as active? None in particular, ranging in frequency from about 3% to 8%. So I was really surprised at how well false discovery rate worked on a highly structured situation. Final comment. Sensible measures and transformations of gene expression data could go a long way towards improving the analysis of gene microarrays. There is an alternative analysis to the Affymetrix algorithms, which is known as D-CHIP. I think there's still an emphasis on looking at the differences rather than the log of the ratios. Adjustment for multiplicity is certainly necessary. The usual FDR procedure seems to be pretty safe to apply unless the correlations are negative. And robust correlations of any form are probably sufficient for assessing rough direction to determine whether or not the test statistics are positive or negative. Some further questions for us is FDR controls the expected proportion of false significances out of the number of significances that were declared. That assumes that the expected false significance per test is whatever you said it was, alpha, say. And so presumably if you averaged over everything, some less than alpha, some greater than alpha, maybe that would still hold. I don't know. Placement of replicates. Affymetrix places 6 wild-type genes in the lower right-hand corner. That's where the wild-type genes are. Spatial effects in the manufacturing process. There are designs to manufacture, to minimize AR1 trends in run order. That was an article by Julie Zhu. I don't know if she's still here. There could be designs to minimize spatial effects. Assess sources of variability. It'd be nice to have some robust variance components, but if you do that, you sacrifice the fact that the total sum of squares is equal to the components. And then also the more interesting thing is the two-way and three-way interactions among the genes. That's it.
Time for one or two questions.
Yeah.
Does Affymetrix have any justification for the normalization method?
Any justification for the normalization method? Only insofar as what they do is they recognize that there are different, you know, basically the numbers that come out, that's not really relative to anything. So the numbers that might come out from this gene chip are different from the numbers that come out from that gene chip, so they average them. I mean, they try to get them so they have the average. Don't think so, but I'm not sure. Yeah. Yes?
I just wanted to make a comment about version 5.
Uh-huh.
Which is that people didn't like these negative numbers that they came out with because you can't take logs of them. And so what they've done is they've basically squashed all the data so that if it was negative, now it's no longer negative. And so you just have zero information about any low-level genes.
I see.
Because you can't, there's no variability, there's no information.
Okay. Thank you. When in doubt, throw away the data, huh?
Okay.
Yeah.
I can't resist a small comment. It seems to me that the first part of your talk especially states very clearly that if there was ever doubt that there would be job opportunities for statisticians, that's gone completely. Statisticians aren't going to be out of work for a long time.
Yeah.